being said in the cacophony. "Shit," I said to Gary. "I hate getting in the middle of something like this, but what are we supposed to do?" He shrugged. "I'll go with you," he said, reluctantly. We elbowed our way through the crowd and got between the two parties. "What the hell's going on?" I asked Rebecca. "These people were being aggressive and threatening toward the minister here," she said. "He refused to serve them because they were intoxicated, and they're having a reaction to that." "I will not serve people who are intoxicated," the minister said. "They chose drunkenness over food today. They have to live with the consequences of their decision." I turned to the group of angry men. "It's his food, his decision on who to serve," I told them, shrugging. "The hell it is," said the apparent ringleader, a short man with close-cropped hair. He wore a white tank top and was covered in what appeared to be gang tattoos, although my experience with gang tattoos was limited to what I saw on television. "What's stopping us from just taking what we want?" "I will stop you," the minister said. "I'm a man of peace, but our food will not be used to fuel your bodies for further sinful endeavors. If you take so much as a single wiener, you will be smote in the name of our Lord." "You need to go back to Mexico," said an obese woman in a tight red shirt. She'd been serving food and appeared to be of some relation to the minister, perhaps his wife. "We're doing God's work, and you people are nothing but takers." The man laughed. "First off, I'm Salvadoran, not Mexican. Second, I was born in California, which makes me a U.S. citizen. Third, you're a racist fucking bitch." The minister surged toward him. "You cannot talk to my wife that way," he yelled, while Rebecca and I struggled to hold him back. "Listen, crazy man, I'm getting tired of fooling with you," the Hispanic man said to the minister. He raised his tank top and showed the handle of a gun, then lowered his shirt back down. "We want some cheeseburgers, and we want them now, or someone is getting fucked up." I turned loose the minister and faced the guy. "You have guns? We have guns," I said to him. "We gonna have a damn war over hamburgers and hot dogs? You willing to die for that?" "I don't plan on dying," the man replied, his eyes cold, his voice low. "The question is, are you prepared to die for that?" I looked him in the eye. "I don't think anyone should die for a burger, no matter how good it is. I also think we need to work this out without guns. You turn this up a notch, and there's no telling how many people will get hurt. That what you want?" My attempt at negotiating was interrupted by sirens and a flurry of emergency vehicles pouring over the hill toward us. I could see several police cruisers, a few police SUVs, and even two armored personnel carriers with painted sheriff's department logos. The Hispanic contingent abandoned ship and took off running at the sound of the sirens. It was obvious from the quickness of their response that they'd done this before. The rest of us stood our ground while the vehicles rolled to a stop beside the tent. Two of the police cruisers and a large brown SUV stopped at our tent. The rest of the force continued down to the convenience store where the drinking had been concentrated. Two deputies approached, one with a black pump shotgun, the other with a variant of the M4 assault rifle. The deputies were wearing black fatigues, followed by a tall man in a regular brown sheriff uniform with a wide-brimmed brown felt hat. "You all right, minister?" the sheriff asked. The minister nodded, straightening his clothes and attempting to regain his bearing. "Just a little scuffle," he said. "The forces of righteousness prevailed. Emmett Cox is on his way to the hospital with that sick lady and her husband," the sheriff said. "He told us what was happening out here." "We fed many mouths today, sheriff," the minister said. "The drunks only became a problem a little bit ago." "I'm going to have to ask you to shut it down," the sheriff said. "I can't guarantee your safety. I have an announcement to make to the folks stuck here, and when I'm done, I expect you to have your stuff packed and follow us back in. We'll maintain a presence at the roadblock tonight, but we need all the townspeople back in town. We're stretched too thin to have to go out rescuing folks, no matter how well-intentioned they are." The minister nodded. He had no basis for an argument, although he seemed reluctant to give up his work here feeding the hungry. "We'll be packed," he said simply. "Good," the sheriff said. Can I ask the rest of you folks to work your way down to the exit ramps there? I have some announcements to make, and then you folks can do whatever you're going to do for the night. With that, the sheriff turned and walked back to his blazer. The two men who'd arrived with him stuck around, presumably to encourage us travelers to promptly make our way down for the announcement. "Well, I appreciate the hospitality," I said to the minister. "You guys stay safe and take care of yourselves." He extended his hand, and I shook it. "Oh, hold on," he said, raising a hand to me, then bolting off toward the serving line, returning in a moment with a blue cooler, the kind that holds around a case of beer. He extended it toward me. "I know you missed dinner bringing those folks in. That's packed with food. There's burgers and hot dogs, beans, slaw, all the fixings. It's your reward for keeping the peace." I laughed. "I was just saving that guy's ass," I said. "I thought you were going to take him down." The minister blushed and looked down. "I let my personal objectives get in the way of the Lord's work." I shook his hand again, and we parted ways. Our whole crew was still wandering around, and we reassembled, making our way down toward the growing cluster of people at the foot of the off-ramp. From a distance, we could see that the sheriff was standing atop one of the armored personnel carriers. It was unusual for local police forces to have equipment like that, but it was through the combination of Homeland Security grants and the glut of surplus equipment from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Other deputies were breaking up the party at the convenience store. Some belligerent and uncooperative revelers were face down on the oily concrete, their plastic-cuffed hands behind their backs. With the hotels, businesses, and surrounding parking lots emptied, there were more people here than I would have ever expected. I estimated the crowd to be around 350 or so. The crowd stood on the paved roadway, some sitting on the various guardrails and disabled vehicles. When it looked like there were no more people streaming in, the sheriff took up a bullhorn and addressed the crowd. "Good evening, folks," he began. "I need to make a few announcements, but first I want to express that I'm sorry that so many of you found yourselves unable to make it home due to the unfortunate circumstances that we're experiencing right now. From the information that I'm receiving, there is extensive damage to the nation's infrastructure and to our fuel refining and delivery systems. There's no projection as to when things will return to normal, but it is likely that we may have to endure several months, perhaps even several years of hardship, before all services and conveniences we were used to are restored." This led to a rumble in the crowd. Apparently, some people had not been able to put the pieces together for themselves. Those were the people who would not be prepared for the difficulties of the coming year. Looking around me, I knew that at least half of these people were likely to be dead in a year if government projections on this type of scenario were accurate. Lack of medicine and food would wreak havoc on the population in short order. Some estimates even went as far as to say that serious systems failure could result in a 90% fatality rate at the end of the first year due to starvation, violence, and illness. "I've been on the radio with Virginia emergency management officials, and it's clear that what's going on here at this exit is going on across the whole country. Throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia, up and down the interstate highways, people are clustered at exits and rest areas doing the same thing you folks are, trying to figure out how you're going to get home and how you're going to survive. It's clear, though, that allowing people to stay at exits is not going to work. Things will disintegrate into chaos and lawlessness, just as you folks have seen today. The word we're getting is that FEMA, in cooperation with state and local authorities, is establishing shelters for stranded travelers. The nearest will be about 25 miles away at the junction of I-81 and I-64 near Lexington. Tomorrow morning, a convoy of chartered buses will begin picking up folks at exits and rest areas. The buses will transport you to this shelter where you can receive food, shelter, and have any emergency needs seen to. FEMA staff will assist with developing a plan for getting people back to their own regions, although you need to understand this may take quite some time. If the buses pass by our town, can we get off?" a voice shouted from the crowd. It was a hairy man in a white tank top and a red Bass Pro Shops cap. "I live closer than Lexington." My understanding is that if the bus passes your exit, they will let you off there, although the buses will not leave the interstate to take you any further, the sheriff replied.
What if we don't want to go to these FEMA camps? Asked another man, a bearded trucker in a Harley-Davidson T-shirt with a chain wallet.
The sheriff shook his head. Don't go calling these FEMA camps, he said. These are emergency shelters for stranded travelers.
Does that mean I don't have to go? The trucker asked.
There was no mention of forced relocation, the sheriff said. However, I'm following suit with the actions of other law enforcement authorities up and down the interstate and taking action to shut down this exit after the buses pass through tomorrow.
There was more of a rumble as people began discussing this.
What do you mean by closing the exit? Someone asked. I mean, the sheriff responded, that it'll be like closing time at the bar. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. My force is stretched too thin to have to deal with policing this area. Everyone here will have to leave tomorrow morning one way or another. You can take the buses or you can leave on foot, but you cannot enter our town, and I would heavily advise against setting out on foot. Word is that crime is rampant on the interstate as folks are becoming more and more desperate. There's word of murders, robberies, and sexual assault all up and down the interstate, and law enforcement's obviously unable to respond to everything. We're facing limitations of our own. It's likely that things out there will get worse before they get better.
Gary and I caught each other's eye. We'd seen that increased crime and desperation already. Obviously, it was just a little taste of what was out there in the world waiting on us.
You don't leave a man many choices, the trucker spat. Trust the government to get you home or take a chance on getting killed on the highway.
Yep, that's about the size of it. I could put lipstick on it, but it'd still be a pig,
the sheriff nodded grimly.
If there are no more questions, we'll be back in the morning to coordinate with FEMA and assist anyone who needs help getting on the buses. After that, we'll expect you all to be gone. And just as a warning to anyone who's thinking they might just stay and get arrested as a way of securing shelter and meals for the duration of this crisis, we are not prepared for that. Anyone who does not cooperate will be loaded onto trucks, taken down the interstate, and dumped off at a spot of our choosing, so don't try it.
With that, the sheriff handed the bullhorn to a fatigue-clad deputy and jumped down from the APC. The sheriff and his deputies loaded into their various vehicles, started them, and crept off back past their roadblock, closing it behind them with vehicles.
I thought they'd at least stay and offer some level of security for the night, Gary said.
I guess they've got their own problems, I remarked.
Maybe we should just head back to our room and discuss our plans, Gary suggested. Who knows how long the peace will last with those guys gone. And I'm starving.
You can say that again, I commented, pointing toward the gas station parking lot where deputies had left the handcuffed troublemakers. Their friends were now using knives to slice them free of their plastic handcuffs. They'd be back raising hell in no time.
Chapter 10
Ellen stood in front of the gun safe with the children standing behind her. She was wearing a Petzl headlamp that Jim kept hanging nearby to better see inside the dark recesses of the safe.
You guys need to remember that we have to be safe around these guns, she said.
We've been shooting a lot, Mom, Pete said. We know to be careful.
I know all that, Ellen said. This is different. Your dad's not here, and guns may be a bigger part of our life until he gets home. You need to not touch them unless I tell you to bring me one or unless you're supposed to be using one. Do you understand?
Pete and Ariel nodded seriously.
There may be a time that I ask you to bring me one. How do you handle one safely?
Always pointed in a safe direction, Ariel said, where there are no people.
That's right, Ellen said. What else?
Don't put your finger on the trigger, Pete said. Never put your finger inside the trigger guard unless you're planning on shooting it.
That's right, too, Ellen said.
Always treat them as if they're loaded and ready to shoot.
I'm going to get a few out, and we're going to put them around the house so we can get to them easily if we need to.
Why?
Ariel asked. She was always the practical one who required an explanation. Pete took you at your word. She did not.
Because we have to be on the lookout that no one wants to come take any of our supplies, Ellen said. People may want our generator, our food, or our gas. We may have to protect ourselves. If people come down this way, if anyone you don't recognize comes down this road, you come get me and you lock the doors. You do not talk to anyone. You do not answer any questions. People may do crazy things, and we need to stay away from them.
That's scary, Mom, Ariel said, scowling at Ellen. Why are you telling me scary stuff?
I know, honey, Ellen said. It is scary. That's why we have the guns. They're for protection if we need them. We'll be okay.
When the kids had no other questions or comments, Ellen unlocked the combination lock to the gun safe. As the door swung open, she realized she had not really paid a lot of attention over the years to what was in there. She recognized guns they'd shot and had all been trained on when they went target shooting as a family. It also appeared that there were a lot more guns than she knew about. She wouldn't be surprised if Jim went and bought guns and never told her about it. She knew he also traded different things for guns. He was always concerned about seeming paranoid or worried that she'd say something about the money he spent on them. She never would have said anything about it, though. She understood why he bought guns. It was because he loved his family and he wanted them to be safe. That, and he really, really liked guns. Her plan was to take a few guns she was familiar and comfortable with and place them at strategic locations throughout the house. She began with Jim's customized Remington 870 shotgun. It was a 12-gauge with a short barrel and a magazine extension that nearly reached the end of the barrel. It also had a collapsible M4-style stock and a single-point sling. Jim had outfitted it with fiber-optic sights that were inexpensive but collected a lot of light. They were fast to acquire and made it easy to track a moving target. Jim had told her that he always kept this gun loaded with double-aught buckshot. Utilizing the training Jim had given her on this gun, she drew the pump action back slightly to open the chamber and confirm that there was indeed a shell in the chamber. There was. She double-checked the safety. "This is a very dangerous gun," she told the children. "Well, they're all dangerous, but this one is very loud, and the shot spreads out over a larger area than regular bullets do."
"Of course it does," Ariel said confidently. "It's a shotgun."
"Yes, dear, it is," Ellen said, realizing Ariel had absorbed more of Jim's training than she thought. "Pete, I want you to take this gun and slide it behind the couch by the back door," Ellen said. "Put these shells with it, too. Push it up under there to where we can reach it easily, but no one can see it from the back door."
"Got it," Pete said.
Ellen reached back into the gun safe and removed a bandolier containing more rounds of double-aught buckshot for the weapon and placed them over Pete's shoulder. She then handed him the shotgun, and he left to carry out her instructions. The next weapon Ellen removed from the gun safe was Jim's M4. She didn't know what brand it was, but knew it was one of Jim's favorite weapons. He told her once they were like Barbie dolls for men because of the amount of accessories that could be put on them. Jim's had a few tricks on it, but was not nearly as elaborate as some he'd shown her in magazines. There was a 30-round magazine inserted into the weapon, though no round in the chamber because of a yellow plastic safety device that protruded from it. She picked up the weapon, checked that the safety switch was in the safe position, and then drew back on the charging handle slightly. While she had the chamber open, she removed the plastic safety round from the chamber, made sure the magazine was seated, and then pressed the release button to allow the bolt to fly forward and chamber around. There was a satisfying sound to all those actions, and a comfort in knowing that this weapon was now hot and available to protect them. Atop the weapon was a folding set of backup iron sights, which she knew how to use. There was also a fairly inexpensive but very functional primary arms optic that she'd purchased one Christmas for Jim. She twisted a knob on the optic and confirmed through the clear lens caps that the red dot inside the optic illuminated. She turned the red dot back off, hung the single-point sling from her shoulder, and took a few spare magazines from the shelf in the gun safe. This reminded her that there was an entire ammo can of empty magazines in the basement for this rifle. She also knew that Jim had thousands of rounds of the 5.56 ammunition that this rifle used. Even though Jim had more powerful rifles, she had shot this rifle many times and knew exactly what to expect from it. The recoil was tolerable for her. She understood the operation. She would have the children fill those empty magazines from the basement tonight. That would be a good late-night activity that they could do by lamplight. Ellen handed the full magazines from the gun safe to Ariel. "Carry these, sweetie." To Ellen's surprise, Ariel did not complain about not getting to carry the weapon. They went to the front door, and Ellen propped up the weapon in the corner, where it would be within reach behind the front door. "Put those magazines on the floor beside it," Ellen said. Ariel stacked them carefully on the floor, and they went back to the bedroom where Pete was waiting on them. "What next?" he asked. "The Mini 14, I think," Ellen said, looking through the contents of the safe. Ellen withdrew the Ruger. It was a 1970s police model with Detroit Police Department stamped into the barrel. It was a mostly stock weapon with a leather sling and an extended 30-round magazine. There was also a stack of polymer Tapco magazines to go with the weapon. Only the magazine in the weapon was loaded. The rest would have to be filled tonight. The safety on this weapon always confused Ellen, as it was not marked. She finally remembered how it worked and was able to confirm that the weapon was safe. She checked the chamber and found it empty. She curled a finger over the metal hook beside the chamber, drew the action back, and allowed a live 223 round to cycle into the chamber. She confirmed the weapon was safe again and handed it to Pete. "Put this on the kitchen counter. Make sure the barrel is pointed in a safe direction." She handed Ariel the spare magazines. "Put these on the bed. We'll need to fill them tonight." Ariel carried out her duties, and she and Pete returned about the same time. "Can we get out my gun, too?" Pete said. "We may need it." Ellen considered for a second. "I'll get it out," she said. "But you have to leave it wherever we put it unless it's needed. You can't carry it around or play with it." "Geez," he said. "I know all that, Mom. I'm not a baby." Ellen smiled at him. "I know you're not," she said. "You both are very big and are a lot of help." They beamed. She couldn't help but reach out and hug them both tight to her. When they broke the embrace, she turned back to the gun safe and looked for Pete's gun. It was a Ruger 10-22, shorter than most of the long guns in there, and took a second to spot. When she found it, she drew it out and checked the safety. There was no magazine in the gun. She drew back the action and found no round in the chamber. She handed the gun to Pete. Digging back in the gun safe, she found a trio of the black rotary magazines that the weapon used. She handed those to Pete and then removed three large clear banana clips for the same rifle. They were Butler Creek magazines and held a lot more rounds than the smaller rotary clips that came with the rifle. All of those magazines were empty, and she knew they'd need to fill those tonight also. Fortunately, she knew that Jim kept tens of thousands of rounds of .22 ammo because they used it so frequently target shooting. With the four of them shooting, and with Jim owning nearly a dozen rifles and pistols of that caliber, they could easily shoot 1,000 rounds in a few hours of target practice. "Put your rifle in the kitchen," she told Pete. "We'll fill up some magazines tonight." When she started to close the safe, Ellen saw the rack of handguns on the top shelf and decided it might be a good idea to have a few of those scattered around the house. After retrieving her own Ruger LCP from the vehicle earlier, she'd tucked it in her back pocket, but she wanted to make sure that guns were where she needed them. She removed a 9mm Smith & Wesson Shield, another gun that she felt familiar with. She ejected the magazine and made sure it was full. She racked the slide and chambered around, then set the pistol aside. She picked up a Taurus PT-92, a Beretta clone, and took it through the same process, checking the magazine and chambering around. Then a Ruger Mark III 22 caliber pistol and a Springfield XD in 45 caliber. She made sure each pistol was ready to fire and placed the pistols where she thought she may need them. She put the Springfield XD with its laser sight under her mattress, the Smith & Wesson Shield in the kitchen cabinet, and the Taurus in the bathroom under the sink. Finally, she took the Ruger 22 to the daddy shack and placed it on a shelf just inside the door.
"What can I do now, Mommy?" Ariel asked.
Ellen checked her watch and saw it was dinner time already. She didn't know where the day had gone. Though they had been constantly busy, she was still surprised to find it was already so late. She had ground beef in the refrigerator that needed to be eaten before it went bad.
"Would you prefer cheeseburgers or spaghetti?" she asked.
Ariel and Pete looked at each other. "Spaghetti," Pete said, and Ariel nodded in agreement.
"Let's make some dinner," Ellen said.
"Then we'll need to get some bullets and start filling these empty magazines." Since they needed to run the generator for a few hours to keep the basement freezers cold, Ellen went ahead and started it before dinner. She ended up having difficulty with it, even though Jim had written out instructions on a piece of wood and zip-tied it to the generator. She was able to find the on switch easily enough, but it was pulling on the starter rope that gave her a hard time. Jim had talked about upgrading to a generator with the electric starting, but he'd not done it yet. She finally had Pete come out and give it a shot. He got it running on the first pull.
"You must have warmed it up for me," he told her, patting his mother on the back.
With the generator humming away, Ellen went inside and flipped the 10 breakers and the transfer switch. Those breakers routed 10 prioritized electrical circuits from grid electricity to generator power. It didn't allow everything in the house to run, but it could get them by. As soon as she started flipping breakers, Ellen heard the hum that indicated the water pump was filling the pressure tank. She flipped another and heard the hum of the refrigerator compressor over her head in the kitchen. Even though the generator would power the refrigerator as long as she ran it, she knew that those foods needed to go first. While the well pump ran, she couldn't run any other high wattage items, or she would risk tripping the overload breaker on the generator. When she heard the click of the pressure switch turning off the pump, she knew it was safe to start running the microwave. In the interest of emptying the refrigerator, their dinner consisted of leftovers heated in the microwave and served on paper plates. They had spaghetti, leftover macaroni and cheese, green beans, mashed potatoes, leftover pizza, and a few other odds and ends. Not the most well-balanced meal, but if tomorrow was anything like today, they would easily burn through all the calories they consumed today. Depending on how long this crisis lasted, they may not always be able to eat so extravagantly. The food would go bad in the next day or so if not eaten, so there was little choice. When they finished dinner, they threw their paper plates in the garbage and stacked the emptied pots, pans, and Tupperware in the sink. Ellen made a mental note to remember to wash them while she could use the well water. The generator was not powerful enough to run the hot water heater along with everything else, so she'd have to fill a pot and heat it on the burner attached to their barbecue grill.
"Pete?" Ellen called back through the house.
"Yes?" Pete said cautiously, sensing that he was going to be called into labor.
"Fill the big pasta pot with water and start heating it on the grill burner."
"Well, why can't Ariel do it?" he griped, walking into the kitchen.
"First, she can't lift it," Ellen said. "Second, she's going to wash the dishes when there's hot water. Would you prefer to wash the dishes?"
"No," he said quickly. "I'll fill the water." She patted him on the back. "Just as I suspected." While Pete set about finding the pot, Ellen got a flashlight and headed into the basement. In one corner of the basement was a large yellow job box, a massive steel locker that contractors bolted to the floor on job sites to prevent tools from being stolen at night. It had a shielded hasp that allowed you to padlock it. Without a cutting torch, these boxes were tough to get into. Jim kept it bolted to the basement floor and stored ammunition and a few other items in it. Ellen retrieved a hidden key and opened the padlock. The heavy lid had gas shocks that assisted with opening it. Shining her flashlight into the box, she was amazed at the amount of ammunition Jim kept. She'd been in the box before, helping him load ammunition for shooting, but she'd never looked fully in there or paid attention. It was not hundreds of rounds, it was not thousands of rounds, it was tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of rounds. There were also more magazines for the various weapons. She picked up a plastic shoebox and found it to be full of knives of different sizes and blade configurations.
"Oh, Jim," she whispered,
half out of admiration, half because she didn't know what else to say. Being in the basement, in his domain, made her miss him deeply. She turned her light around the room and saw an empty 5-gallon bucket. She brought it closer and turned her attention to the stacks of ammunition. Remembering the M4 and Mini-14, she knew that they needed more 5.56 caliber than anything else. There were large boxes and small boxes. She scanned them, then took out several 20 and 50-round boxes of 5.56 from brands like Wolf, Tolamo, American Eagle, and Federal. When she had about 500 rounds in the bucket, she switched calibers. She took a 500-round brick of .22 for Pete's gun and stuck it in the bucket. For the pistols, she took a 250-round box of Remington UMC in 9mm and .45. For good measure, she grabbed another 50-round box of Speer 380. She hadn't even made a dent in the supply. There were additional calibers in there that she didn't even realize they had weapons for. She had to assume Jim had a few tricks up his sleeve. At this very moment, she was comforted by that thought. Though she'd had women friends who were scared of guns, she'd always found them comforting. The contents of this box and the weapons upstairs would go a long way toward assuring that she and her children were not victims of the desperate and immoral. She took the bucket upstairs, surprised at the weight of the ammunition. With the bucket bouncing off her leg, she made her way down the hall and into the bedroom, where she sat the bucket down with a thud. With the generator running, Ariel had wasted no time in putting in a DVD and was lying on Ellen's bed watching a movie. Ellen had forgotten that the bedroom was wired into the transfer switch, but recalled Jim doing it when the kids were younger so they could watch TV during a blackout. That distraction would make the whole event easier for both the parents and the children. "I'll need you to wash out those pots and pans when the water heats up," Ellen reminded her. "Okay," Ariel replied weakly, as if exhausted by the burdens already placed upon her today. "Good girl," Ellen said. "Now I need you two to help me fill up all these empty rifle and pistol magazines." Ariel perked up at that. She found anything to do with guns much more entertaining than dishes.
"Go get Pete," Ellen said. "You two can watch the movie while we do this."
Chapter 11. Back in our gloomy hotel room, Gary and I sat on the floor by the glass balcony door and dug into the cooler. We offered to share, but the women all said that they'd eaten their fill at the tents before we got back. That being the case, we ate as much as we could, not knowing where our next meal would come from. Even cold, the burgers were delicious. Maybe not worth dying for, but pretty damn close. Ever the facilitator, Gary cleared his throat and leaned back against the patio door, speaking between bites. "Maybe we should talk about our plans for tomorrow to make sure we're all on the same page." I kept eating. Group discussions never went well for me. They always turned into a fight when I was involved. People said it was because I was oppositional. I said it was because they were assholes. Alice, also used to being a facilitator, jumped right in with him.
"That's probably a good idea, Gary. I don't see that there's much to discuss, though. Sounds like we really only have one option here, going by what that officer told us today."
"There's never just one option," I commented, knowing that I should probably keep my mouth shut. I'd moved on to a hot dog with chili and coleslaw now. It was good, too. "Of course," Rebecca said. "Mr. Difficult over there can't just agree with anything. You tell him the sky is blue and he has to offer an exception." I ignored her and concentrated on my hot dog. I thought of responding to her with my middle finger, but I could occasionally show some restraint.
"Before you're so quick to label Jim," Gary said, "I wanted to bring this up because I'm pretty sure we all will not be in agreement with how to proceed from here."
"Really?"
Alice asked. She was looking at Gary curiously, as if he'd announced a move to the dark side. In her eyes, that meant that he agreed with me on something. Gary looked at me as if waiting on me to jump in and take over with the explanation. They were less likely to argue with him since they felt he was less antagonistic. They already thought that I was disagreeable and contrary, and I agreed with that, so I left Gary to it. I was both enjoying the food and enjoying someone else taking the contrarian position for a change. Let him lay out his arguments and see how they dealt with it. I would enjoy the show and try to keep my mouth shut unless I was shoving food into it.
I can't speak for anyone else, but I'm not comfortable with placing my trust in FEMA, Gary said. I want to get home. I'm very worried about my family. Y'all know I have a house full of daughters and granddaughters that I'm very concerned about. I think I can get myself home faster without entangling myself in FEMA's bureaucracy. Amen, I said, between bites of baked beans. The beans were good, too. I had the thought that churches probably actively recruited good cooks, using them to lure heathens like myself into the fold. It was practically a conspiracy.
So what exactly are you planning on doing? Rebecca asked. Walking home?
From the look on her face, the pure astonishment, Gary might just have easily announced that he'd be taking a goat as his next wife. Gary looked at me and shrugged, still looking for some backup.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. I'm not sure that's safe, Alice commented, always acting as the risk manager.
Her tone was both maternal and condescending, as if she would start patting him on the back of the hand while she was making the comment. I put down my plastic fork and took a swig of my warm bottled water.
I'm pretty sure it's not safe, I said.
There's no guarantee that those camps will be safe either. There's probably not much of anything that can absolutely be guaranteed to be safe anymore.
But it's not about safety. It's about having control of your own future. I am not about to relinquish that control to the government.
Hell, we work for the government. We're as aware of the inefficiencies as anyone could be.
The government is not the enemy, Rebecca hissed, exasperated.
You conspiracy theorists wear me out with your crazy bullshit.
In some cases, the government is most definitely the enemy, I shot back.
That's not exactly what I'm talking about, though. I'm talking about capability. I'm pretty sure I am capable of getting myself home in a couple of weeks on my own by walking. I've backpacked extensively. I am not sure FEMA is capable of getting us home efficiently. We may sit in those FEMA camps for months while they attempt to work out the logistics of getting people home. Remember that once you're there and safe, you become less of a priority for them. Getting you safely to the camp is more important to them than getting you home.
You don't know that, Alice said.
No, we don't know that for sure, Gary interjected. However, experience and history suggest it. I'm not trusting my life and my family's safety to them either. How would this work if our own agency was in charge of these camps? You know, with fuel limited, we would conduct a survey in order to figure out a route where we could drop the most people off using the least fuel. That process of surveying and determining a route could take a week or two, especially if the situation's constantly changing with new people showing up. You know this is just going to turn into some kind of mess. The task will be so daunting and resources so limited that nothing will get done.
You could always go and see what it's about, Rebecca said. Then you could leave later if you wanted to. You'd at least be about 25 miles further down the road. That's 25 miles you wouldn't have to walk.
No way, I said. I'm not turning my weapons over to them, which they would probably require prior to getting on their buses. Also, I bet residents of the camps will not be free to come and go as they please. That would make the camp too difficult to secure. My guess is that the camps will be fenced and guarded, and they will limit traffic in and out.
That's pretty paranoid, Rebecca said.
Gary shook his head. In this case, I don't think so. I've read those government reports on disaster response. I know how they will respond. Jim and I are of a like mind on this. I think we'll try our luck on foot.
Alice turned to Rebecca sitting beside her on the bed. So I guess you and I are taking the bus out of here tomorrow.
Rebecca nodded.
Damn right,
I think you guys are nuts for trying to walk home.
Randy, Alice said, you haven't said anything. I'm assuming you're going with us, too. Are the girls sticking together?
Randy was standing in the patio door, smoking a cigarette and blowing her smoke outside. She was slow to respond, appearing to think it over.
No offense, Alice, but I think I'm going with the guys.
Really? Rebecca asked, clearly shocked.
Oh, hell yeah, Randy said. I would go nuts sitting around a shelter worrying about my grandkids. At least this way I'm doing something. And like they said, I'll be in control.
Well, I think you're crazy too, Rebecca said bluntly, staring at Randy.
Well, I think you're a fucking snarky bitch, and I've about had all of your condescending attitude that I'm gonna take,
Randy replied without hesitation.
You've never shown me the first bit of respect in all the years that I've known you, and I'm over it. You open your mouth to me again, and I'm going to slap your damn soul right out of it.
It was so damn funny I nearly spat chocolate cake out my nose.
Let's not argue, ladies, Alice said, quickly intervening. There's too much going on for us to waste time fighting with each other.
Rebecca was staring at Randy. Randy stared back, amused. I had no doubt that Randy would slap the shit out of Rebecca without hesitation if Rebecca opened her mouth again. Rebecca seemed to realize this also.
Randy will be glad to have you, I said. We'll need to do some planning tonight to get ourselves ready. We'll also need to consolidate your luggage down to something easier to carry.
She sighed.
You mean leave the expensive, heavy shit behind, right? Like shampoo?
I nodded.
I don't have luggage, Randy, Alice said. Anything you want to leave in your bag, you can give to me, and I'll take it with me. I'll get it back to you whenever we get back to work.
That'll work, Randy said.
Thanks.
After the sun began to set later that evening, there was a lot of noise and yelling coming through the open patio door. Music blared from a car stereo, and I was glad that I wasn't outside. It sounded like trouble was brewing. Since there was no law tonight and they would be forced to move on tomorrow, this night would likely present a good opportunity for folks intent on getting into trouble. Gary and I sat on the floor, Randy beside us. Despite my recommendation that they not do so, Rebecca and Alice had taken a walk. They were determined to find some type of restroom facility, or at least a more private bush than the one the desk clerk had pointed them to earlier. Their desire to stay out late was probably driven by my warning to stay in. What the hell did I know, right?
Is your bug-out bag fully stocked? I asked Gary.
Yes, it is. I built it off the list you gave me, so it should be mostly like yours, with a few personal variations.
What the hell's a bug-out bag? Randy asked. Y'all gotta speak English around me.
A bug-out bag is basically a survival kit for an event where you might have to get the hell out of Dodge, I answered. Mine and I guess Gary's are primarily designed to get us back home in the event of an emergency. Some people refer to it as a get-home bag.
She stared at me. You take that damn thing everywhere you go?
Not everywhere, I replied. Just if I travel any distance from home. There are a lot of people out there, me included, who felt that it was just a matter of time until some shit-hits-the-fan scenario took place and that we needed to be better prepared.
Are you like some doomsday survivalist or something?
She was not the least bit accusing or condescending, just curious. She leaned forward and whispered,
Are you guys in a militia, too?
No, we're not in a militia, Gary chuckled.
Jim and I just started talking about this at the same time. It was after Hurricane Katrina. I never thought the people in our country could just be abandoned like that for days to fend for themselves. When I saw the footage of those people in that convention center, I swore I would never be one of them. Jim and I talked about it at lunch every day. We started reading books, following websites, and found there were a lot of people like us who felt the same way.
Y'all care if I smoke? Randy asked.
We both shook our heads. Anyway, we both carry about the same basic items with a few extras thrown in. We have some food, water, a means of shelter, a way to start fire, and spare clothes. We also carry at least one firearm and spare ammo, I said. Tonight I'm going to repack my bag and get things ready for tomorrow. I'm also going to do a little recon through the hotel and see if I can pick up anything that might help with our journey.
I didn't bring any of the kind of stuff you guys brought, she said. I just brought girl shit, plus a pocket knife. My daddy always said a girl should have a knife.
Your daddy was right, I said.
How am I going to carry my stuff? Randy asked. Any ideas?
Well, I thought about that earlier, Gary said, getting up and taking a pillow from the bed. I thought we could make a drawstring pack out of a pillowcase.
Gary dumped the pillow out of the case.
He drew a Kershaw folding knife from his pocket and put a slit in the wide hem near the opening of the pillowcase.
Hand me some cord, he said.
I pulled out a roll of 550 paracord from my pack and started to cut some off, but had trouble making myself do it. I looked around the room and saw the cord hanging from the blinds on the patio door. I decided to use it instead and save mine for later. I drew the blinds to the position that left the most slack in the cord and then cut it free. That left me with about 15 feet of strong white cord about the same diameter as the paracord. I handed it to Gary. Gary threaded the cord through the hem of the pillowcase, creating a drawstring closure. At the bottom corners of the pillowcase, he tied knots in the case. He then took the excess string from the drawstring, halved it, and tied the end of each half around the knotted ends of the pillowcase, creating shoulder straps. This would allow the pillowcase to be worn on the back in roughly the manner of a backpack.
"Take this," Gary said. "Put what you need in there from your luggage. Be very selective because we've got a long way to go and this will not be comfortable with a lot of weight in it."
Randy stared at the pack.
"What should I bring?"
"Another pair or two of your thickest socks, comfortable underwear, an extra pair of pants, an extra shirt, any jacket or raincoat you might have, maybe any extra lighters. Just the bare minimum, pretty much. And wear your most comfortable walking shoes," I instructed. Randy threw her suitcase on the bed, opened it, and started sorting.
"I'm going to do a quick inventory," Gary said. "I need to get my pack arranged in a more usable manner if I'm going to start living out of it. A lot of the items I have in here are still in store packaging, and I'm going to get rid of that if I don't need it. I also want to get my ammo more accessible."
I went to my own pack, opened it, and removed an LED flashlight that hadn't cost more than a buck.
"I'm going to do a quick recon," I said. "There may be useful stuff here in the hotel. Normally I don't approve of stealing and looting, but times are desperate, and if I find some extra snacks or something that may help us get home, I'm going to take them."
"Understood," Gary said. "I wouldn't mention it to Rebecca and Alice. They already think you're some kind of deviant."
"Let them think that," I laughed. "I don't give a shit."
"I think they also know that you don't give a shit," Gary replied, grinning.
I slung my pack on my back and headed out the door. "I'll be back in a few."
"Be careful," Randy warned.
I entered the quickly darkening hallway. The reek of human waste in the humid air was getting worse. This hotel would need some serious work when this disaster was over. I made my way down the hall to the stairs. My plan was to start my search for supplemental supplies on the upper floors because they had fewer guests. Since the elevators were not working, the desk clerk was putting everyone on the lower floors. The stairs were dark and smelled as fragrant as the hallway. I climbed to the sixth floor and exited into the hallway. The floor was bright enough that I could move in the hallway without my flashlight, but only because there were no obstacles. It was dead still. I guessed from the layout of my floor where the vending room was located, so I made my way there and through the metal door. I turned on my flashlight and discovered the same machines I'd seen on my floor, two drink machines and a snack machine. With no power, the machines were useless. No lights glowed. No compressors hummed. The drink machines were heavy-duty with massive padlocks on them. They were designed to be vandal-resistant and would be impenetrable. But the snack machine was a different story. I dropped my pack to the floor and removed my Gerber LMF knife. It had a sharpened steel pommel that was designed so that a chopper pilot could use it to hack his way out of a helicopter by cracking the plastic shell of his windshield. I gripped the knife by the sheathed handle and rammed the pommel into the plexiglass window of the snack machine, cracking it instantly.
The noise was loud in the tiny room, and I hoped there was no one on the floor to hear it. A few more blows and a piece fell free, creating an opening that I could reach through to remove snacks from the corkscrew holders inside. I hesitated and listened for a moment to see if anyone might have heard me, but there was no sound. I avoided the bulky, nutritionally deficient foods, such as chips and pretzels, and focused on taking the more calorie-dense snacks. I took all the candy bars and energy bars, the bagged nuts, and the snack crackers topped with cheese or peanut butter. There was a whole row of beef jerky, and I cleaned that out. I ended up with about 3 dozen snacks, which I crammed into the various side pockets of my pack so they would be easily accessible tomorrow. Carrying my pack by the straps, I exited the room and walked across the hall to the housekeeping closet. I turned the handle, and it opened. These doors were intended to be locked, but rarely were in any hotel. Inside was the housekeeping cart for this floor, as well as floor-to-ceiling shelves of the various items needed for restocking a guest room after it was vacated. On one shelf, I saw a box of the large garbage bags that were attached to the cart. The maids used these bags to contain all the smaller bags that they removed from the rooms. I tore off about a dozen of these, rolled them up, and stuck them inside my pack. They could be used for sitting or laying on wet ground, for constructing a shelter, as a raincoat, or maybe even as a sleeping bag if the situation required. I took 2 extra rolls of toilet paper. I had some in my bag, but I hadn't planned on traveling this far, and with extra people, more may be required. We would likely reach a point where leaves were needed for the task at hand, but I would enjoy the luxury of good old TP for as long as I could. I also picked up a few bars of soap and stuck them in a side pocket. Staying clean and sanitary on the trail helped prevent stomach bugs. I found a box of the smaller garbage bags that were used in the guest rooms, and I took a dozen of those, too. I could use them to wrap items, like the toilet paper, to keep them dry if we got rained on and my pack got soaked. Finally, I noticed a stack of blankets on a shelf. These were the blankets you usually found in the closet in a hotel room in case you got cold at night. I took 3 of them, laid them on the floor, and rolled them into a tight roll about the size of a sleeping bag. I took a piece of cord from my pack and wrapped the roll to keep it from coming loose. I took 1 more of the big garbage bags and shoved the roll of blankets inside. I would attach them to the bottom of my pack later. They would be more comfortable over the coming weeks than using the emergency Mylar blankets I had in my bug-out bag. No matter how warm wrapping yourself in a Mylar may be, it would never be as cozy as a blanket. I shouldered my pack and tucked the roll of blankets under my arm, slipped out of the housekeeping closet, and paused in the hallway. There was no sound. I made my way back to the stairwell, cracked the door, and listened. It was quiet. I entered the stairwell and descended to the next floor. At the 5th floor, I opened the door and listened. Quiet here, too. I walked from one end of the floor to the next and heard nothing. I slipped into the vending room and checked out the machine. It was untouched. My pack was not big to begin with, not much more than an overnight pack, and with the addition of the items from my luggage, it was pretty full already. With the TP and snacks, I had started having to cram things in. I knew from backpacking that you burn a lot of calories hiking. With the snacks I'd relieved from the upstairs machine, and with the items I already had in my pack, there might be enough for all of us for a couple of days. Assuming Gary had food also, the additional supplies might add a few more days to our stock, but there was no way to know what resupply opportunities would be available. There might not even be any resupply opportunities. It would be best to take food when it was available. I decided I'd better crack open this machine, too. When it was done, I put the contents in one of the small plastic garbage bags to see if Gary could fit it in his pack. Before exiting the room, I listened at the door. Nothing. I put my pack on, tucked the rolled blankets under an arm, and carried the garbage bag of snacks in my hand. I walked the carpeted floor to the stairway door and reached to open it. Before my hand touched the pull handle, the door burst open, nearly hitting me. I backed away, startled, my free hand dropping my weapon. "Whoa!"
I said, partially out of surprise, partially to make the person pushing the door aware that I was here. The guy opening the door was startled, too, and muttered a curse. I stepped farther back, wanting to keep my distance until I knew who I was dealing with. Had someone heard the noise? Was it hotel staff? Another guest? Three men came strolling through the door, close enough that I could smell beer on them. I kept my hand on the grip of my pistol, ready to draw it if I needed to. I nodded at the men. They looked at my pack and the load in my hands, then moved on down the hall, trying doors and talking in Spanish. They obviously had no more business here than I did. One of them turned and looked back at me again. Before they could decide I was a target, I was through the door and headed back to my floor. I reached the room without seeing another person, although I heard more voices coming from rooms when I got to my floor. I knocked on our door. "It's Jim," I said in a low voice. I heard steps, and Randy opened the door. When I went in, I could see through the patio door that the sun had dropped below the horizon, and it was nearly dark now. "Are they back?" I asked. "We're here," Alice said from the dark depths of the room. "I'm glad," I said honestly. "It looked like it was getting a little sketchy out there." "More than a little," Rebecca said. "If I have to pee again, I'm going on that patio there. There's no way I'd go back out there." "We saw a brutal fight," Alice said. "I don't know what started it, but there were a lot of people standing around watching. One guy was down on the ground, his face all bloody, and he was getting pounded and kicked by some big guy. I think they may have killed him." "You guys didn't try to intervene?" I asked. "I know how you like to mediate other people's conflicts." "Well, fuck you," Rebecca said. "We didn't. This is not the kind of climate where you try to mediate anything." "I'm glad you're finally realizing that, Rebecca. That's our new world for a while." "When we were coming back, two men followed us," Alice said. "They were talking shit and making comments. We got scared and ran. They laughed at us but didn't follow."
"I'm sorry that happened to you," Gary said. "But remember it, and don't put yourselves in a situation again where you're defenseless."
"I won't," Rebecca said. "Well, I won't either," Alice added. "I'm looking forward to the safety of some type of government-operated shelter."
"I hope it is safer," I said.
Rebecca moaned. "Let's not revisit that."
"We won't," I said. "The time for arguing is over." I walked across the room and gave Gary the plastic bag of snacks. "Got room for this?"
"I do," he said.
He tucked it away in his pack without opening it, although I'm sure he could tell what it was through the thin garbage bag. I dropped my own pack and loosened the straps on the bottom. When they were loose, I used them to attach the blanket roll to the bottom of my pack.
"What time are you guys leaving?" Alice asked.
I looked at Gary. He shrugged, which I took to mean he hadn't really thought about it.
"I'd like to be out of here about 5 a.m., I said. "There's a reason police make raids at that time of day. The lowlifes are usually out cold by that time, and you still have a little darkness to conceal your movement. I'd like to leave without anyone knowing we're leaving or wondering what we have in our packs. I don't want any confrontations or questions."
"Sounds reasonable," Gary said.
"The sooner we're out of here, the better," Randy piped up.
"How about we go ahead and sack out?" I suggested. "I'll set an alarm for 4:45 a.m. and we'll head out then."
"In case you don't wake up when we leave in the morning, I wish you ladies good luck," Gary said, addressing Rebecca and Alice.
"Thanks, Gary," Alice replied. "I hope you guys get home safely, too."
We all settled in for the night. The women in the beds, Gary and I on blankets on the floor. We left the patio door open for fresh air. Outside, music still blared. Hispanic rap trying to drown out AC/DC. A woman could be heard crying in the parking lot below our window. A baby cried beyond that.
"Could you slide that door closed?" Randy asked in the darkness. "I don't think I can sleep listening to that."
I slid the door closed without a word, sealing out the night.
Chapter 12. The night was restless and uncomfortable, but somehow we were all asleep when my alarm went off the next morning. I quickly silenced it, and the three of us wordlessly threw off our blankets, slipped on our shoes, and gathered our stuff. Gary and I used our headlamps to make sure we didn't miss anything. I gave Randy the backup flashlight from my bag. I had a couple of them in there, and I told her to hang on to it in case she needed it later.